Good morning, everyone. This is Joe Gray with Seven Generations Radio. You're listening to WSHC Shepherdstown, the voice of Shepherd. And I've got an interesting lineup for you today. We're going to talk about some things that might warm you up. We need a little bit of that. My first guest will be Michael Judd. He's going to call in from Frederick. He is... been working in the field of permaculture and edible landscaping for many years. And he's got a book out called Edible Landscaping with a Permaculture Twist. And it's got a lot of good, interesting information in there that is very useful. So he'll be calling in about 11:05. And 11:30, Bradley Sanders from the Folly will be in here. And he is a bronze worker, worked with the forge and metals for many years, and he is a bronze artist, makes great creations and useful things working with metal. So he's going to talk about fire and metal. And along with him, Joy Breedy is going to be in here of Joy Breedy Pottery. And... she's also in the local area, Shepherdstown, not far from Shepherdstown. Beautiful work that she has done, that she does do, and this may be McCall coming in right now. WSHC, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. It's Michael Judd calling in.
Hello, Michael. Wonderful to hear you.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I've been, I just made a brief introductory remark about you and your work and your book. And I kind of like to start off with the end of your book, Edible Landscaping with a Permaculture Twist, where you talk about your roots, where you got started, some of your experience in Mexico, Nicaragua, and Appalachia. Would you want to take off on that a little bit?
Sure. I've had a very fortunate and rich past, beginning in some ways down in southern Mexico and Guatemala. There's a last stretch of jungle there between the two countries called the Lacandon Jungle. And within the Lacandon Jungle, there's one of the last of the true Mayan tribes that were never conquered by the conquistadores and the Christians. And I had good fortune to go and live in one of these remaining communities in the jungle. And during that time, got to see how we as a species, as humans, can live regeneratively on the same piece of land. I watched this Mayan community harvest all of their food, all of their fibers, all their fodders, all of their building material and craft material from the forest around them. And what, sorry, go ahead.
Yes, please.
And what looked just like a wild ecosystem was actually intimately managed by the Mayan community. And that changed my understanding dramatically about what's possible, both as what we can do as humans and the kind of relationships that we can have working with the land and with the ecologies around us. And that shaped the rest of my journey, which put me in Nicaragua 15 years ago to start Project Bonafide, a grassroots nonprofit focused on long-term food security through planting out diversified food forests. So helping regenerate landscapes that have been slashed and burned to grow cash crops, rice, beans, corn, and bring back not just some of the original diversity, because the climatic patterns have been changing throughout the world and very much in Central America. So we've also been doing research and bringing in types of nuts and fruits and perennial greens from other parts of the world that have similar climate patterns, which is basically an extended dry season and a strong monsoon season. So an example of that is bringing things like jackfruit. It has a wonderful value as a windbreak, a valuable timber, a valuable fruit, and then a valuable protein carbohydrate with its seed, what we call sometimes a permaculture all-star, that it's hitting all of these multiple functions. That was the nutshell.
And how different is it when you go into a foreign land like that and you begin to work with the native? Now, if you work with the native people, I could understand how you could get yourself started. But when you're trying to apply permaculture techniques that you bring in, does that make it difficult, the fact that you're coming from more or less an alien environment into that world?
Yes. And when I first started the project, I was coming from very much a mentality of North America, in that I was fundraising from my community to start the project. And from the get-go, when you start fundraising, a lot of people are like, well, what's your projected plan? You know, let's see some numbers and let's see some, you know, some written out descriptions of what you're going to do. So that already kind of started pushing me in a set direction of what I was going to do, which was my learning curve. When I really landed on the ground and lived in this very rural, isolated community, even with the best ideas of creating food security, diversifying, market niches, et cetera, the reality was that I needed to slow down and listen to the community, listen to the elders, ask them what they would do if they had the resources to do it. And I did. I slowed down, and I started where they were ready. So an example of this was I was wanting to start a children's nutritional program that was going to have children planting the foods, harvesting them, cooking them, getting to know the new foods. And the community was more interested in the children brushing their teeth, getting multivitamins, and getting milk. So I had to backtrack and say, okay, let's start with that. Let's see how the community supports itself, comes together, volunteers. And that was 10 years ago we started that program. And today, a decade later, it is really strong in its organization. And only now does it begin approaching the education of new species and getting the children to grow and to harvest and to cook things. So I had to really sort of put my visions and aspirations on the back burner and begin where the community was ready. And every time I did that, with every approach, every project I had in mind, I've had success. When I've jumped in with a strong concept and a project and the community has not been ready for it, it's always failed. And so that's probably my biggest learning and success.
Well, that kind of brings on the question of mindfulness and awareness and being present where you are and listening, instead of like bringing in an agenda and trying to deliver it regardless. I had an experience in South America myself. I went to Bolivia. I was out in the jungles in a region called Madidi, which is pretty remote Amazonian. And it's ecotourism, but it's run by native people strictly, and there's not much touch with the outer world. It takes about a four-hour boat ride to get to this place. And the guide, who is a native, walked through the jungle and talked about the trees, the leaves, the plants, and the things that you could do with them. And it struck me that it was like I was walking through CVS or Walgreens, and instead of blue and red little packages, he had everything that he needed, you know, for headaches, for menstrual cramps, for whatever you need, and he knew where to find it and how to use it. And I said, you know, this is real knowledge. And it's amazing how we have lost touch with that. And I know this is something that you're trying to bring back, which is our touch with nature and our ability to work with nature. So I'd like you to launch off a little bit and talk about permaculture. It's getting to be that time of year where we're thinking about, you know, spring and growing stuff. And what should people be thinking about? And how can people get a start in this direction. Sometimes it's hard. That first step is sometimes the hardest thing to do. And then I'd also like to hear you talk a little bit about mushrooms and mycelium and that sort of thing, because I'm kind of fascinated with all that.
All right. Let me segue a little bit from my experiences in Latin America and coming back to live in the States. I'm originally here from Frederick, Maryland. And to come back, this is my fifth year back, I had to translate a lot of what I'd been learning, both culturally and with the growing systems, to our current environment, which in East Coast here, the Mideast, is very suburban and urban and homestead scale. I mean, there are still some farms, but the majority of the people in the landscape is in these more intimate neighborhood situations. So I took a lot of the concepts of permaculture, of food security, of looking at your whole landscape holistically so that it flows together, with the understanding of aesthetics, with the understanding of all the runoff we have from our roofs and our driveways, the issues with the Chesapeake Bay and all that runoff, our lawns, our grass. So I've taken the concepts of water harvesting, of food production, you know, of natural building, and blended them into a very aesthetically pleasing and acceptable urban-suburban design, which is what my book is based on, very how-to examples of what we've done. And to get into your question now, what can we do to start? When I look at a landscape, when I look at a yard, of any scale, the first thing I look for is water flow. How is water moving across the landscape? How is it coming off the roof? Where is it going? Is it coming from off-site onto it? And I look at how to capture that water. So what we call in permaculture earthworks, basically shaping the ground so that you are slowing, sinking, and spreading the water. Now, most of us are familiar with the concept of a rain barrel. It's a 5-gallon rain barrel at the bottom of the spigot. And in a good rain, we see that overflows in 3 to 5 minutes. And then the rest of that water is just gushing out. And often, very quickly, you know, running off our landscapes. It seems our modern landscape is designed to push water away as fast as possible, often carrying a lot of chemicals with it. So it's kind of taking that and tweaking it, so to say, so that we put that water movement on contour, which means we find the level part of our landscape, and we create these raised beds called swales on contour. In my book, I talk about them as basin and berm, where basically you're digging out a basin and mounding the soil on the downhill side to create a berm. That's your raised bed. Now, since these are on contour, which means they're sort of running even on the landscape, when water falls into that basin, it stops and it sinks in. Not being pushed away, it's being held in the water table, and it's recharging the water table, not only for that raised bed you've just created, but for 10, 20, 30 feet beyond. Then go ahead and plant and mulch those beds, and you've got natural water harvesting every time it rains. And that's sort of creating a sponge on your landscape to hold that water. So you're stewarding the water from running off, you're helping filter it, and you're growing amazing plants from it, and you're not having to drag your hose out there and try and keep up with your plants in the drought. So when I look at a landscape, water is almost always my first consideration. If it's an exposed area, then I think about wind. Wind and water go hand in hand. If you've got an exposed site, you're going to be losing moisture. And you're also, I've discovered in a lot of areas, if you're exposed, you're also picking up more sort of wind-carrying disease and much more insect exposure. I recently rented a house in downtown Frederick where I created a garden behind the house, and then it extended just past the house where there was an open fence. And I could markedly see where the house ended. I had this beautiful, lush growth, no disease, no insect problems. As soon as the house ended and it was exposed, you know, by a fence, it was full of weeds and full of disease, and I struggled with that patch immensely. So it was an obvious observation that the windbreak makes lots of difference. So I always consider windbreaks and water harvest when I first look at a landscape. And a lot of times that windbreak can also, you know, double as a function around your garden as a perennial habitat. So maybe it's fruit bushes, maybe it's gumi or blueberry bushes. that are breaking the wind, but then also creating that perennial habitat for insects to help overwinter and balance your garden the next season.
Okay, and how about working with native plants as opposed to, you know, the more common like apple trees, et cetera? How do you gravitate toward the native plants?
I do not per se. I have sort of a deep ecology perception of plant evolution. And I always look for what plants are sort of well adapted, naturalized, which, you know, some people do call native plants. Plants have come from all over forever. We've sped the process up a bit with our modern world, but plants have always been spread around the world by birds, insects, disease. All these things have always rotated around the globe. So look at plants that are adaptive, that are strong, that naturalize easily and are carefree to put in a landscape. Now, often those are natives, but a lot of times there's others that are called non-natives that fit that much better and will have a food or medicinal value that really outcompetes what we call native. And there's a couple spins on that, which I guess we don't need to get into. But I, generally speaking, I stay away from some of the fruit trees that take extra care in our very humid mid-Atlantic climate. Those would be peaches, most of your plums, nectarines, most of your apples, and let me see what else, cherries in general I would stay away from as well. Now, there's exceptions, and there's sites where one of those will do really well, but generally speaking, you're going to have to put a lot of care into those, and if that's your focus and you have time and you're sort of a ninja pruner and fruit tree grower, then that's great. You can do it. I do it with a few of my trees, but if you're not very experienced and you're wanting to get started, I would start with things that are proven to be much easier, carefree, and very productive and tasteful. Examples would be the pawpaw. This is pawpaw country. Pawpaws grow really well here. They're very insect and disease-free. I do recommend planting grafted varieties of pawpaws, and you want to plant at least two. They're very ornamental and very easy. The persimmon. If you're in Point South or you have a protected area, the Asian persimmon is great. The American persimmon is a fantastic tree, and the Asian American hybrids also make a beautiful, carefree tree that produces lots of fruit.
That's great. That's great.
Juniperberries.
Great advice.
Are pretty easy and carefree, as are a lot of your bush fruits. In general, growing bush fruits and cane fruits are on the easier side of getting started with fruit growing.
I like that advice because I think one of the greatest frustrations is to plant some of those other, which are more popular and that everyone goes for, and they get frustrated because it's so difficult. They're invaded. There's so much care that's required. And then if you go over to some of the plants that you're talking about, people will be successful and then they'll keep doing what they're doing. You know, I think that's great. Would you want to shift over to mushrooms and talk about mycelium and mushrooms for a while?
Fantastic, yes. Mycelium is the body of what creates mushrooms. So mycelium are these little connected threads of cells that we sometimes see when we're in the forest and we kick across the leaf litter, we'll see these white webs. That's mycelium. That's the body of the fungi. So when fungi has run through its organic medium, whether that's wood chips, forest floor layer, logs that you've inoculated, tree stumps, when that mycelium has colonized and is very happy, it will then pop out the mushrooms. That's the fruit. It's kind of like thinking of an apple tree, the tree being the actual body, and then the fruit is the apple. So the mushrooms we eat are just the fruit of the mycelium. And the mycelium play endless roles in creating healthy ecosystems and gardens. I think of them always as a keystone species, meaning a critical link in having a healthy landscape. And basically, having lots of organic matter consistently, like a forest floor does, helps draw in that mycelium and all the benefits it has. Now, you can go further and cultivate mushrooms like shiitake and oyster very, very easily by using a lot of the hardwoods we have around us, maple, oak, poplar. Really, there is a large list of different types of trees we have that will grow certain types of mushroom. The most obvious and successful ones we know are shiitake and oak. They really love each other and they do really well. I've had a lot of success with our poplar, our tulip poplar and oyster mushrooms. And of course, there's crossover with the maples, with both doing oyster and shiitake. And then of course, there's lion's mane and reishi and a whole other host of characters that are great to grow right in the backyard, in the front yard, wherever you have shade close to your house is a wonderful place to grow mushrooms. So basically, the timing is coming up to be cutting wood. Now, you want to cut healthy wood. It has to be fresh, live, healthy wood you're cutting for log production. And so let's say in the next couple of weeks, you can go out and you can find, you know, a small oak tree. We're talking diameter of about 6 to 8 inches, or a branch that has the same diameter would work great. Sometimes saplings, small sapling trees in our woods here, we have an abundance of poplar saplings that need thinning to help bring in more light and regenerate the forest floor. So we're going out into the woods and we're actually selectively thinning and helping speed up the healing process of our woods by harvesting the mushroom logs. So there's this win-win from the beginning working with fungi. So we'll harvest out these logs and about 6-inch diameter by about 3 feet long. And you can go bigger. You can go a little bit smaller. Really, it's just about manageability. And then we'll let them sit for about a month while the temperatures warm up to about 50-degree days, hopefully that soon. And during that time of cutting them, we can go ahead and we can order spawn online from some place like Field and Forest Products. They are like a seed company for all things mushroom. And they'll send you little wooden dowels inoculated with a strain of, say, shiitake or, say, oyster. Then what you'll do is you'll drill your log about every 3 inches all the way around, and you'll knock in these little wooden dowels that have the mycelium on it, and then you'll wax them closed to seal them. Then you'll lay your log where it's moist and happy, and the mycelium will jump off those little dowels into your log. And when they've colonized that log and they're happy, they're going to start popping out fruits. And usually that can take up to 12 to 18 months. You have to be patient. But then they will produce for you annually. So you'll get probably 2 natural flushes a year off your mushroom logs, and usually in sort of late spring, early fall. And depending on the size of your log, that can go up to 8 years. So once you've done a little bit of input, you actually have a perennial fruiting log, which needs nothing but the shade in your yard.
And you've got a workshop coming up in April on this, don't you?
Yes, we have a very fun workshop, usually twice a year, in the spring, in the fall, for doing mushrooms. And we do hands-on. So we go through the process of what I just talked about, of drilling and waxing the logs and learning about all different roles of fungi in our landscapes. And everyone takes home their own mushroom log. And it's a wonderful time. And the benefit is also that we hold these up at our homestead here in Frederick, Maryland, just north of downtown. We have about 25 acres of mixed woodland open areas here. And everyone gets to see during the workshop the other things that we're doing. They get to see our gardens on contour, the swales I just spoke about. They see our young food forests. Depending on the time of year, there's some funky, uncommon fruits. They see our trellising. They see our natural building, our straw bale that we're building. So it's always an experience beyond whatever the subject is. But yes, we just put that up on our website for, I believe it's Sunday, April 12th. So please come and join us. I think you'll really enjoy seeing where we're at, what we're doing, and I know you'll love learning about fungi and mushrooms.
And what's your website, Michael?
It's ecologiadesign.com. So that's a Portuguese word, ecologia, and then design.com. You'll see a whole vast array of things that we're up to on the site. And of course, the book that we created also is a very how-to, and it has a chapter on growing fungi, on creating garden beds on contour, of starting food forests, of uncommon fruits. Gets right to how-to.
And we got a couple minutes left. Would you like, is there anything that you're currently into that you're real excited about that you'd like to disclose to listeners?
Absolutely. Well, many things. Today, particularly, I'm out tapping black walnut trees for sap. Right now, starting today forward, is going to be the ideal time around here to start tapping our walnut trees, our maple trees, our birch trees, and our hickory trees to start pulling out sap. And it is really easy to do. You could spend 10 minutes on YouTube and you'd figure it out, how to go out there and start doing that.
And what do you do with that sap?
You can either drink it straight, and it's kind of a very sweet cleanser for this time of year, or you cook it down. You sort of boil it down into what we know as syrup. You know, maple syrup, then the black walnut has its own flavor. So they're just, you know, they're different types of sap that turn into syrup. So that's one thing I'm excited about and doing today. We're also pruning our grapevines, and I'm collecting scion wood. So I'm collecting grafting wood today off of my persimmons, off some mulberries, off my pawpaws. And now's the time to do that and save that wood in your refrigerator, and then you can go ahead and graft that onto other trees and rootstock once things start to leaf out. So right now is actually a wonderful time to be pruning, to be cutting scion wood, to be tapping your trees, also cutting, getting ready to cut your mushroom logs, you know, in preparation for, you know, sort of the spring and the permaculture spring to come. But the big thing that we're really excited about working on is our circular straw bale home. We have built our home out of our woods, literally, by cutting and hand peeling mostly poplar logs. We've done round wood timber framing, so round wood columns, round wood rafters, sawmilled all our wood on site, and straw baled and filled. We're doing earthen plasters and lime plasters, living roof, earthen floors, and it's a piece of art that we hope finish this summer.
Excellent. So folks would get a chance to see that?
Yes.
See
yes,
some of that?
It's all part of getting to come to our workshops, and we'll do a summer tour as well. That's just a walkthrough of our landscapes and our house. That's on the website as well, and that's in June.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Michael. And if there's anything else you want to add, you go right ahead. We've got another minute. Otherwise, go ahead.
What I encourage people to do is to just go for it. I think we get caught up culturally thinking that we need to be experts or we need to read a lot to get out there and get started. And it does help to do a little bit of reading, but really getting out there and just going for it is how we actually learn. We get the muscle memory and the confidence. So really don't feel like you need to know a whole lot. Just go out there and you will learn.
Experiment and do it.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Michael. It's great talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
You might see me at your workshop.
All right, good.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, we've been talking.